talk about an anthropic origin for the neutrino mass from cooling failure. And this is based on some work with my advisor, Rafael Busso, as well as Dan Meinemer-Katz, who's another graduate student at Berkeley. And it should appear soon on the archive. In the meantime, any feedback would be, of course, appreciated. All right. So I'm going to start out by phrasing what the problem is. So recently, we have discovered that the neutrino, a lepton in the standard model, has a small but non-zero mass. So expressed in terms of the mass sum across the three flavors of neutrinos, the current observational bound is that this mass is bounded between 58 MeV and 0.23 eV. And the lower bound comes from neutrino oscillation experiments, and the upper bound comes from cosmological constraints. So you can imagine asking, why does the neutrino mass sum take this value? So more specifically, why is it small compared to the masses of other leptons in the standard model? In particular, why does it happen to take a value that affects our cosmology just enough? In other words, it affects cosmology enough to be measurable and to figure into cosmological constraints on this value. However, it doesn't affect it so much that it disrupts the formation of galaxies and otherwise makes conditions inviable for life. So this leads us to the question, could this have an anthropic explanation? All right, so before I proceed, I just want to put out some definitions. I'm going to consider two cases for the distribution of the individual masses among the different flavors. One case is the so-called normal hierarchy, where a single neutrino has mass m and the other two are approximately massless. A second case is degenerate, where you imagine there's some symmetry which relates the masses of the three neutrinos, so they each have mass approximately m over 3, and none are approximately massless. There's an in-between case you could consider called the inverted hierarchy, where you have two of mass m over 2, one approximately massless. That case should be somewhere in between our in terms of our results, so I won't consider it explicitly.
Is the degenerate hierarchy described
in oscillation experiment? We don't know yet what the correct hierarchy is. That has yet to be determined. So there's kind of different bounds. So the one I quoted here is kind of the worst case value. It's the lower bound actually comes from the normal case. For the degenerate hierarchy, the bound is a little bit higher, but there's still a lower bound set from neutrino oscillation experiments.
By degenerate hierarchy, it just means a big zero offset.
Yeah.
I see. So the splittings that you get from this, the oscillations are all too small.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. Sorry.
So, you can just talk about normal and inverted hierarchy, is there a reason?
Is there a reason you mean to restrict to these two?
No, I mean, you said degenerate hierarchy instead of an inverted hierarchy. So I thought the inverted was you have two masses,
yeah,
and one low mass, but now you have three masses.
Yeah, so these are kind of the two extreme cases. I'm going to consider these two cases. The inverted hierarchy the result should lie somewhere in between the two cases that we consider.
It would just depend on whether cosmology is sensitive to the larger of the splittings that makes degenerate different from inverted. If you weren't sensitive to the smallest value of the splitting, then degenerate would just be the same. Mm-hmm.
It's probably true that the particle physicists anchor the bottom one at zero, and then that kind of would make two and one natural rather than all three of them.
I mean, in other words, question is where the bottom. Do you put the bottom at the lowest state or at zero? I mean, if you put at lowest state, then.
Yeah. There is a question of degenerate. Where's the zero coming from?
So you imagine that there's some symmetry that approximately links the masses.
Yeah, so you have the three coslines and then. Well, below this. Zero is what? Zero the
mass.
The mass,
okay,
of the neutrino. Zero EV.
So, in other words, the case on the left is the case where the sum of the neutrino masses is as small as it can be, consistent with observations, and the case on the right is where it's as large.
Right. Perfect.
All right, so to proceed, I'm going to briefly go over my outline for the talk. I'm going to start by discussing how we compute probabilities to answer this question. I'm going to review a little bit about structure formation in the presence of massive neutrinos, which will be important for our calculation. I'll start by presenting the actual calculation with no cutoff, and I'll explain what that means later. Essentially, I'll include the entire range of masses. Then I'm going to proceed to explain why there's a certain range of masses, high neutrino mass, where we actually believe there's an additional anthropic effect due to cooling. I'm going to review cooling in our own universe, and then discuss how we might imagine it proceeds in this very different universe with very massive neutrinos, and end by presenting our final results, including a cutoff, and some conclusions. So to start out, how do we compute probabilities? How do we address this problem? So I'm going to address this question in the context of a large landscape of low energy vacua, for example, such provided by string theory. One motivation for considering this is the cosmological constant problem. It appears that in that context, one can naturally explain the cosmological constant fine-tuning problem. In any landscape, we will have eternal inflation if at least one of the metastable vacua is sufficiently long-lived compared to its Hubble expansion rate. And so we can imagine that in a very large landscape, this would be very likely to be true for at least one of the vacua. If we're talking of order 10 to the 500 vacua, it would be a conspiracy to not have one of them which satisfies this. So if you meet this condition, then there's infinite volume produced by the inflating vacuum, which means that there's all possible realizations of different realizations of low energy physics. For example, different values of the neutrino mass. And you can compute relative probabilities for different possibilities. So in this case, you can say that the neutrino mass scans. There's some probability distribution, and you can ask what is the most likely value, and how does the value that we observe compare with the most likely value? How many sigma does it lie from the median of this distribution?
I mean, the fact that all possible realizations occur, I mean, that's more of an assumption than I mean, it's not really an implication necessarily, right? I could imagine that even though I have an infinite volume, somehow the physics is constrained such that only a small region of the parameter space gets scanned.
So like a selection effect, kind of?
Yeah.
So we're kind of assuming that there's not some kind of selection effect, and there are reasons to imagine that that's a good assumption.
If you can imagine that, then you're not imagining hard enough.
Actually, I would argue exactly the contrary that we should expect.
I know,
I can do this later, but I'm saying, you know, there's no reason to think there is any landscape in string theory, and certainly 10 to the 500 is completely fictional, and if anything, in a hot universe, I would argue we should expect more or less unique, but.
Okay, so first of all, I just want to emphasize that I'm talking about a theory with a large landscape. I'm not necessarily, but yeah, and I also,
you know,
I would,
some
okay.
We can argue about it later.
Okay. All right, so to be a little more concrete, how do I actually compute these probabilities? So I'm going to condition on the existence of observers who can make a measurement of this parameter, in our case, the neutrino mass. And when I do that, I can take the probability proportional to the number of observations, and I can construct a conditional probability distribution. So this splits into two pieces. One is the so-called prior distribution, which tells us the distribution of the neutrino mass, or whatever other parameter we're scanning, over the metastable vacua of the landscape. The second piece is an anthropic factor. It tells us the number of observers that actually are in a vacuum where m nu takes this value. So of course, this quantity is actually infinite, so we have to also include a regularization by some appropriate measure. And I'll describe a little bit more about that later on when I discuss the actual calculation.
Is the regulation by measure just another prior? Can you just think of it as one sentence?
Well, so you can imagine that if you really understood some fundamental theory, it would come with some prescription for regulating the infinities. At the moment, we're taking more of a phenomenological approach. We don't really know what the right measure is, so we imagine trying different possibilities and testing them phenomenologically against different things. Does it lead to a Boltzmann brain problem? Does it lead to a correct prediction of this and that quantity when we're scanning different parameters?
So it's a prior on a different theory, and you take each theory and you compute across the area.
I wouldn't really call it a prior, but it certainly, in a similar way, if one knew the ultimate theory that our landscape comes from, we would hope that that would come with a prescription for actually regulating these infinities.
Are you able to provide a prior?
Well,
they get an infinite answer. You mean some way to regulate it, and she's saying that you would really like to be able to cue that from first principles. No one knows how to, so we'll just do something that isn't obviously silly.
No, I think so. The real question is, I mean, everything is phenomenological here, so your choice of F would be phenomenological?
So that's actually what I'm going to talk about now.
Okay. The question is, would you be able to fold in your regularization if your choice of F, or do you have to do that separately?
No, it's definitely a separate thing. So maybe this will be a little more clear when I talk later on about the measure. So to start out with the prior. So in some cases, there's good motivation for a certain prior. In the case of neutrino mass, we know less about what this prior actually is. This prior, of course, is the differential number of vacua in some interval over a log of the neutrino mass. And so I'm going to have to make some assumptions about this prior in the case, I'm going to assume that the prior has no special features around the observed range. And I'm going to parameterize this by taking the prior proportional to some power of the neutrino mass. So note that when I take n equals 1, this is the same as having a distribution that is exactly flat over the neutrino mass. In other words, dn by dm is constant. N equals 0 is the case where it's flat over log of the neutrino mass. And so this kind of parameterizes the deviation from flat, like the force that the prior has towards larger or smaller neutrino masses. And we are going to translate our results into constraints on this prior. So if we find at the end of the day that this value of n is order 1, then we would say if the prior order 1 is consistent within 2 sigma with the observed value, then we would say that we have an anthropic solution for the neutrino mass.
Can you build that? Another one is the opposite.
Why?
Essentially independent, then how can you conclude?
So there's 2 pieces. There's the prior, there's the anthropic part.
Yes.
If hypothetically I didn't make this assumption, I put in the answer by hand into the prior, then it's not an anthropic solution to explain the value of the neutrino mass. The solution comes from this anthropic part. It comes from telling us how neutrinos affect structure. It doesn't.
So you really mean to say if you assume that it's flat and you can come up with something that's consistent, then you're going to do it.
I'm not actually assuming it's flat. I'm I'm varying n, and I'm seeing what the consistent values of n are. Yes?
This is not the only hierarchical problem the standard model masses. The uptown quark is a few NuV, whereas the top quark is 73 GeV. So there's a huge hierarchical problem. So why don't we just use the anthropic principle to determine any of the masses of the standard model?
So that's a good point. That's a good point. Obviously, due to finite time constraints, I have to pick one such parameter I'm going to look at. But the more general program is that one would like to understand this more generally for different parameters. People have done the cosmological constant. People have looked at the value of the weak scale.
This is a personal bias
coming
out. I do firmly believe that there's a solution to how the masses of the standard model particles are determined, some kind of eigenvalue equation, which I don't know. So therefore, I don't want to use that proper principle, because there are ways of doing theoretical physics to determine how things work. For example, the hydrogen net was a problem for historically, for a long time. What produces the splitting of the hydrogen? The Bohr model was completely.
So John, I think that these are open-ended questions that should be answered at the end of the talk.
No, but the whole thing is an open-ended question.
Well, this is not how she chooses at the end.
So can I come to a question? You're talking about observed value. What do you mean by observed value?
So that's what I...
We have no way of actually measuring n because we're just in one particular...
Maybe I wasn't clear. I'm talking about observed value of the mass, not of the prior.
Well, then how would we know that n,
which is
a parameter in a distribution, is consistent with a particular observed value?
Yeah, so this might be a little more clear later. So for any value of n, I will get a probability distribution over the neutrino mass. Then I can ask questions like, I don't know what the observed range is, and does that lie within 2 sigma of the median of that distribution for any value of n? And that's what I mean. Does that make sense?
Okay, and so...
It's like any cosmological measurement that we do. We have a model, and then we have a measurement.
But I understand what you're saying, but what you're also saying is that although we've got a distribution of possibilities,
and we have one observation,
that's
kind of
goes to the center of the distribution, even though that we only have one observation. So
that's
like
cosmology.
That's cosmology. we have to work with what we have. But you can imagine, you know, like we're not just looking at the neutrino mass. We have many, many different. I mean, the program is that you can try many, many such things like this, and successively see the more data points you have, the more confidence you gain.
I think there might be a better way to phrase this than like consistent with observed value of the 2 sigma. Like sigma isn't really the relevant quantity here. Like a more relevant quantity would be to ask what the relative entropy gain is, like prior compared to posterior, or rather in this case, the weight of the entropy gain that's coming from your prior compared to your anthropic factor, and that gives you, you could plot a relative entropy as a function of the shape of the prior distribution, and the relevant thing is when does the relative entropy cross one, i.e. when do you gain more information from the anthropic factor than from the prior.
Okay, I mean, you could consider different ways of parameterizing this, but I think this is a reasonable
sigma
criterion.
We could just think of this as a very basic problem. The advance that everybody understands it.
All right, good. So moving on. All right, so next, this anthropic factor. I'm going to return to talk about this in a lot more detail soon, but first, I just want to mention some basic things. First of all, to compute this, we need some proxy for observers. So for example, you could imagine making some proxy be the number of galaxies. Say the number of observers is proportional to the number of galaxies. And this leads you to something like the Prisch-Schecter formalism. which would allow you to compute this. It encodes the effect of massive neutrinos on structure formation in a way that I'll explain. And of course, we should check at the end that our final result is not sensitive to the exact details of this definition. Okay, part two. So now I'm just going to review some basic facts about structure formation in the presence of massive neutrinos. So massive neutrinos suppress structure at small scales due to free streaming. So this is the schematic picture of what's going on. So neutrinos have some thermal velocity, and they have some typical distance that they free stream. And so imagine during the matter era, there are these different density perturbations which are growing to ultimately form structure. And if I have a region of overdensities that's large enough, that's the first picture, the typical distance traversed by these neutrinos is going to be small compared to the scale. In other words, the neutrinos remain confined to this region, and they participate in growth as dark matter. And the density perturbation just, as usual, grows like the scale factor during the matter era. On the other hand, if I have a region of overdensities which is small enough compared to this free streaming distance, then the neutrinos will transport energy away from these regions, and it will actually suppress structure on these scales. So this is the growth then becomes a scale factor to some power p, where p is slightly smaller than 1. So how does this figure into the power spectrum? So here I'm plotting the dimensionless cold dark matter power spectrum versus k over h. The first plot is m equals 0. The second plot is m equals 3 eV. And you see, as expected, that there's a suppression of power selectively at small scales, in other words, large k. And there's also some onset of this suppression at this so-called free streaming scale KNR. And you can see that as we increase the mass, so here I'm going to go to 5 eV, you see that the suppression at small scales becomes more pronounced. And simultaneously, the free streaming scale pushes to higher values of k. So we see that increasing the mass pushes this onset to the right. So in order to compute the anthropic factor, we're going to use this so-called Prescher formalism. And essentially, we're assuming a Gaussian distribution for the density contrast. And here, sigma r is the density contrast smooth on some scale r. So I can imagine this distance scale r translating into some mass scale. Here, rho is rho of baryons in cold dark matter. And Prescher tells us that if our overdensity exceeds this critical value of 1.69, then this region collapses, becomes nonlinear. And we can compute the fraction of mass in halos that are larger than this scale m, corresponding to the scale r, just from this integral. So the picture we have here is that we have these overdensities, and some will exceed the critical value for collapse, and they will collapse. So in our case, we're interested in galaxy-sized halos. In other words, we take m to be 10 to the 12 solar masses. This corresponds to a scale r of 1.3 H inverse megaparsec. So you can see that this this fraction of mass in halos depends on this smooth density contrast, and that's what's going to encode the effect of massive neutrinos. So how do we compute sigma? Well, roughly speaking, it is just the integral under the curve of the dimensionless power spectrum. In reality, I smoothed this out some way using some top hat window function that was not elucidating enough to actually write the formula on the slide. So this, morally speaking, is what we do. And we're integrating up to this cutoff, which is this scale r. And in our case, again, we take this to be the galaxy scale 10 to the 12 solar masses.
Did you look into the fact that the perspective is appropriate for this? I mean, for the nuances, or I guess we discussed this.
So, I mean, ultimately, one would probably want to do simulations and check. I don't think there are. I mean, simulations. In general, people tend to do them close to the actual observed universe.
Right.
So.
You need to find all simulations.
But if anyone in the audience would like to simulate this and tell me, that would be great.
The thing is, particular. Right. I wonder. So I mean, the thing I think about is usually perspectives with design for cold dark matter. What happens with the, I guess with the hot dark matter that you have is the growth rate doesn't go as a growth doesn't go as a when there's a to a different power.
Yep.
And that would change the, for example, the collapse threshold.
It does change the collapse threshold, and that's something that we're not taking into account.
Okay.
At the level we're working there, this is somewhat crude, and we're making some approximations. There's actually a paper by Mari on how this affects the collapse threshold, and you see that it actually grows with neutrino mass. But she didn't actually. The result doesn't extend into the full amount of the range we consider.
Right.
Basically, the.
Small contribution to the whole cold dark matter.
No, but the point is that she wants to push it to large masses to see why they're excluded.
So
and I'm saying that there are two differences, the effect on the power spectrum and there is the effect on the growth, right? That those, I mean,
wait.
If you, right? So those are independent effects that, I mean, they could be comparable to each other. So
you're asking about the effect on the collapse threshold or the.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Mari finds that in the region up to about 1 EV, it grows slightly. So if one wants to take the philosophy that we're taking a conservative approach and we're taking the choice that most makes our results look worse compared to what would make the things agree within 2 sigma, then increasing is fine. Okay. All right. So I'm moving on to the actual calculation. So recall again that what we're computing is this conditional probability distribution, which splits into this prior, this anthropic factor, and has some appropriate regulation by a measure. And we're taking this prior to be proportional to some power of neutrino mass to some power. And so for definiteness in the plots that I'm going to show, I'll take n equals 1 exactly flat case. But in reality, recall that we're scanning over n to find the possible allowed priors. OK, so I should mention what measure I'm using. So I'm using the causal patch measure, which has thus far been quite successful. It counts only events in a single causally connected region of space-time. Averaged over all possible trajectories of some world line. And within a single FRW vacuum, the patch boundary is just given by the event horizon. So this is the picture you should have. This patch is just the past light cone of the future endpoint of some world line. And we're counting the number of events inside that patch. The patch boundary is a cosmological event horizon. In other words, the furthest distance away that there could be some light ray that causally affects this world line. And I'm saying this to be precise, but it does appear that in our case, the results are not strongly sensitive to the choice of measure. I mean that if you try, essentially we have another, let's see how to explain this without getting into too much backlog. There's another case there was a paper about 10 years ago where people looked into this question of anthropics of neutrino mass. And they use a different measure, one which is actually inviable now for various reasons. One of the reasons for doing this was we wanted to revisit their work, given that that measure is now actually inviable. But if you compare with what they had, the differences are actually due to this anthropic factor. The actual effect of the measure isn't at the root of the differences of the two approaches.
Okay, so it doesn't mean to say compared to some other approach, you got roughly similar results.
Yeah, yes. And that's not to say that you could imagine there's some other measure that could give you a different answer, but in two cases they appear to give the same.
Just for me to understand, are you counting the number of observers in that causal class?
Yes. And the motivation for considering that, it's motivated by basically black hole physics. If you have complementarity, you run into these paradoxes if you try to take a global perspective, but if instead you restrict to some causally connected region of space-time, then you resolve these paradoxes. And similarly, you get a finite answer in these calculations. Oh. Okay, so now let's go into a little more detail about this anthropic factor. So for definiteness, I'm going to take the rate of observations proportional to the production rate of galaxies. So I'm, in other words, the number of observers is the integral of the time derivative of the mass in galaxies within the causal patch. So here we have rho bc is the density of baryons and cold dark matter. V is the physical volume of the patch, which is successively suppressed at late times, exponentially suppressed past T lambda. And then FR is this Preschecker factor, which tells us the fraction of the mass in halo-sized galaxies. And this, of course, depends on the smooth density contrast sigma R, which encodes the small-scale suppression of power by massive neutrinos. And of course, like I said, you choose a slightly different definition. Say you take the total number of galaxies instead of the production rate of galaxies. The effect on the result is negligible, as it should be. OK, so before I go on, I need to clarify, it's very important how we keep things fixed in our cosmology as we vary across this parameter. So the philosophy is that we want to keep all fundamental physics other than the neutrino mass fixed. And this translates into fixing the value of the cosmological constant, flatness, and the mass per photon of baryons and cold dark matter. And you can work out the implications, and you find that omega matter, the density of matter, and the Hubble all increase with neutrino mass in a way that you can calculate, whereas the densities of baryons and cold dark matter is fixed. So this will be actually important later on. No. So we're fixing lambda, we're fixing flatness.
But if you increase the neutrino mass, the matter density increases, right?
In the way that we're fixing things, yes.
Omega lambda would decrease, but lambda itself I keep it fixed.
So omega lambda is
increased. Yeah, so that essentially that's the same as saying that Hubble can vary. Maybe that's a little counterintuitive. Okay. Okay, I lost here. Okay, so the strategy in our calculation is that we vary the neutrino mass following our fixing scheme. We then use Boltzmann codes such as CAM and CLASS to output the power spectra for these different cosmologies. Then we integrate over the power spectrum to compute the smooth density contrast up to the galaxy scale. And we do this as a function of both neutrino mass and for a wide range of redshifts. So we actually have to use a fitting function in regions of negative redshift because CAM does not output negative redshifts for obvious reasons. But we only fit in that region, and that region actually has a negligible effect. Otherwise, we we use direct data.
Sorry, why do you need negative direction?
Because we're integrating over all time in the causal patch. Now is not a special place.
Oh, like it says it's at the future of the syntax.
But that's also a region that is suppressed. Yes, as well as the volume of the causal patch. Okay, so then we integrate against the causal patch volume, weighted, of course, by an appropriate prior, and we find the probability distribution. And again, as I said, we vary the prior to find an acceptable range consistent with observation. So when we do this, what do we find? So now I'm going to plot this function sigma against the neutrino mass. And you find something surprising. So free streaming, you would expect this to cause sigma to decrease. And you see that it starts to decrease, but then it starts to increase. So what is going on here? Let's take a step back and look at try to figure out the origin of this behavior by looking at the dimensionless power spectrum. So as we've seen, if you plot this for zero EV, this is monotonically increasing, function of k. And as you increase the neutrino mass, we see the suppression at small scales. And then if you keep increasing the neutrino mass, you actually develop a peak in the dimensionless power spectrum at scales around this free-streaming scale. And so we see the onset of this peak occurs around 10 eV. And we see that, so this critical mass 10 eV, above this mass, this dimensionless power spectrum develops a peak near the free-streaming scale. And this signifies a regime change, where the integral, which recall the integral is what gave us sigma, this integral becomes dominated by the peak rather than the cutoff scale. And furthermore, due to our fixing scheme, where the matter density increases with neutrino mass, the peak actually grows with neutrino mass since for two reasons. First of all, because KNR, the free streaming scale, increases, and also because the length of the matter era increases with neutrino mass. So that is what causes this turnaround and this increased amount of structure predicted past exactly around 10 EV. So we see more structure above 10 EV. And so if you naively try to then construct the probabilities.
Did you explain what the difference between the two curves there and the previous plot?
The previous plot. Oh, so, I'm sorry. Yeah, I should have said that. So the two curves are the two hierarchies. So orange is normal hierarchy, and the green is the degenerate hierarchy. And both of them have an upturn, but it's more dramatic for the case of the normal hierarchy.
And 10 EV is because that's recombination?
10 EV...
Because these are kind of moving past the... there's already a feature in the power spectrum at 10 EV.
10 EV is just because that's the point where the power spectrum goes flat.
Which is because of...
That's because of free streaming.
But 10 EV, I think it's like superimposed over the overall shape of the power spectrum, which has a scale encrypted at like quality combination, you know, whatever, which is about temperature about 10 EV. The horizon size of equality.
Okay, but I mean, what is setting this is the flatness of the power spectrum.
I think these two are related to each other. So it has to do with when neutrinos take over dark matter, right? Which I think turns out to be roughly a border. Is that 10 EV? Yeah.
Yeah,
somewhere around. Yeah, 10 EV.
I think 15 EV is from there.
And is that just a coincidence as opposed to 13 EV?
I don't think it's a coincidence.
Right.
I mean,
it's the same.
But the combination is not 13 EV, it's 0.1 electron volt.
Okay.
because of cosmological reasons, it's much lower temperature. But I think it happens around that there. I think that one can figure out why this is not, I don't think it's a coincidence.
So you also, when when you're relating things, you also have to be very careful about what you're fixing, right? So we should make sure that we're comparing things with the same fixing scheme. Okay, so this is the naive result that you get for the probability distribution for the exactly flat case. And you see that there's this upturn at high neutrino mass starting around this point 10 eV. And the reason for this is twofold. First of all, it can be traced to this behavior in sigma. And it's also further accentuated by the weight of the prior towards high neutrino mass. So we can see by looking at this, the high mass region dominates the probability distribution. And there's here's, in red, there's the observationally viable region. And you can see just by looking at this that if this is the probability distribution, then the observed value is inconsistent. The model is ruled out. However, there's some funny things happening in a high neutrino mass. So let's take a step back to try to understand exactly what's going on in this region. Do we actually believe that it's viable anthropically? So here again is this dimensionless power spectrum. And so we saw that the point of transition was around 10 eV when this went flat. But this actually roughly coincides with some other regime, important regime change, which is that you can see that at exactly this point where we develop a peak at lower k values, the integral sigma is no longer very sensitive to the cutoff scale, which means that if we plotted sigma as a function of halo mass, it would be roughly flat. And what that means is that all scales go nonlinear at approximately the same time. So there's a drastic change in a structure formation scenario. So to reiterate, dimensionless power spectrum goes flat implies a transition away from the traditional bottom-up structure formation scenario to one where perturbations go nonlinear at all scales roughly simultaneously. In other words, the top-down structure formation scenario. So this is a drastically different universe, which you can imagine may be inviable for observers. So next, I want to propose a mechanism, in other words, suppress star formation from cooling failure. All right, so first, to review cooling in our own universe. Once the cold dark matter overdensities exceed the critical density, then they go nonlinear and they virialize into halos. And baryons that fall into the gravitational potential of these halos get shock heated to the virial temperature by the virial theorem. And in order to collapse further into stars, the baryons first need to sufficiently cool. So this can occur through many different processes, line cooling of an excited electron, Bremsstrahlung, where an electron is deflected by a charged particle and accelerates, or very early on, you could have inverse Compton scattering of an electron against the CMB photons. There's a criterion for efficient cooling, which is that the cooling timescale has to be less than the gravitational timescale. So we can do a rough back of the envelope calculation. Starting from the virial theorem, we can find how the virial temperature depends on the virial density. We know what the timescale for, let me just for simplicity say that our cooling is dominated by Bremsstrahlung. We're at high temperatures. Then this cooling time is, we can calculate what it is. We can also say that being conservative, this gravitational time scale is roughly set by the age of the universe at the time that it virializes, which has some dependence on the virial density. And we can combine all these things and find at some, this is very crude level, we can translate this into this cooling criterion into the following. And we see very roughly that for some fixed virialization time that's larger than order 1 gig a year, the cooling criterion is actually violated once the halo's mass is large enough. So we can see this a little more precisely in the following plot, taken from a textbook. So here, the y-axis density, you should think of that as a time coordinate. The x-axis is the virial temperature, and these dashed lines tell you the different halo mass sizes. So these two lines are exactly the lines that exactly satisfy this cooling threshold. So outside, cooling is inviable. Inside, it's viable. And you can see that, okay, so this is for two cases of different metallicity, zero metallicity and solar metallicity. The details don't exactly matter, but what's important is that you can see that in this high mass region above 10 to the 12 solar masses, you're outside the region. In other words, you're in the region where cooling is not efficient. Okay, so in our own universe, let's review what happens. We have a bottom-up structure formation scenario. That means that smaller galaxy-sized halos form first. As we saw from the previous plot, this is within the mass range where these halos can cool efficiently. Therefore, they produce stars and hence observers. Later, larger halos will form, and these halos may inherit the earlier galaxies. However, the larger halos cannot cool efficiently themselves, and therefore they do not produce their own stars significantly. So now let's move on to consider this top-down scenario, this region above around M is 10 eV. So we have a very different picture here. As we discussed, in this case, perturbations will go nonlinear roughly simultaneously at all scales, galaxy scale, halo scale, et cetera. And this means that the regions will virialize together. And the scale of the potential is set by the largest halo, thus so is the virial temperature. And as they virialize, the smaller substructures are washed out. We know that in our own universe, such halos don't form stars in any reasonable abundance because of issues with cooling. And so there's no reason to expect anything different to occur in these regions, in these universes with large neutrino mass. There's no reason to suddenly expect there to be more galaxies.
Right. There are different parameters.
Yeah. But okay. So that leads me to my next point, which is that so these processes are complicated. There's lots of feedback and different considerations. So while this is I believe good motivation to believe that there shouldn't be a reason to cool efficiently in this case, it would be important to check with actual simulations. Yes?
I mean, there'll be another transition later on, though. Like, once the neutrino mass goes beyond a kV, then the free streaming scale is larger than the baryon filtering scale, and you'll no longer affect the formation of low mass halos. The formation of the first stars won't be affected once the mass gets beyond, like, I don't know, kV or something.
So there. Once you get high enough, the neutrinos are essentially cold dark matter, right? Is that what you're?
Yeah.
That's what you're saying, right? So in that case, we don't. Okay, so in that case, there are other issues. So in terms of anthropically, you could imagine that the baryon fraction is diluted, so that forms some obstruction to cooling for a different reason. But you can also, independently of the anthropic fact. The anthropic part, at that point that neutrinos are cold dark matter, we actually already have an anthropic calculation that, based on a paper that Raphael wrote with Lawrence Hall, varying the cold dark matter densities. And in that case, and that region would be inviable based on that calculation. where essentially you find that having too high a density of cold dark matter, the measure is what's doing the work for you in that case, but that region is suppressed. I don't know if I said that clearly.
So I just want to say, I mean, in lieu of simulations, I mean, the plot you were showing in the previous slide, I mean, the same plot is still there, so you could just do the same back of the envelope thing, but you just need to update the density. So, it's just the relationship between the mass of the halo and the density and temperature would be different for different cosmology.
Yeah, so you sort of have to redo spherical collapse with neutrinos.
Right, which is
I wouldn't say it's back of the envelope.
No, I mean, the thing that you were showing, like the relationship for Bremerson that you were showing, those are basically just realization time. So now this is, there are various layers of complication that, I mean,
yeah.
How much time you could spend.
I think we agree. I think the point here is that it would be good to do this more quantitatively for however you want to phrase how one does that. So for now, however, I hope that this is sufficient motivation to believe that it's quite reasonable to consider that there will be an obstruction in this region. And so I'm going to proceed by saying that there's a cutoff at this scale 10 eV. So of course, in reality, it's not some sharp cutoff. It's smoothed out in some way. But for now, I'm just going to assume some sharp cutoff. Of course, this will slightly overpredict in the smaller region and underpredict in the larger region. But these are the results. So left is normal hierarchy, right is degenerate hierarchy. This is for the case of a flat prior. And these shaded regions are 1 sigma and 2 sigma from the median. And this vertical red line is the worst case observed value in either case. And you can see that in either case, the worst case observed value is within 2 sigma. In the normal hierarchy case, just barely. So we say that this is consistent. We mildly prefer a degenerate hierarchy. And it holds for a range of priors around order 1. So in terms of the prior variation, we can see, so there should be actually a shaded region below 2. On the y-axis, we have standard deviations. And here, we're varying prior. So the best match is given by a prior slightly below 1/2, but you can easily read off from this exactly what range is consistent. All right, so now I just want to end with some conclusions. First of all, as I've explained, we constructed a probability distribution for the neutrino mass sum using the causal patch measure. However, we saw that in this case, it's not really the measure that's doing the work for you. What matters is the anthropic factor. Increased neutrino mass suppresses structure. However, surprisingly, we found that actually more structure is predicted past around 10 eV. With no anthropic reason to exclude this large mass region, our probability distribution would significantly disagree with the observed range. However, we saw that this regime change roughly coincides with this transition from bottom-up to top-down structure formation. And we argue that this is catastrophic to observers due to cooling failure. Again, it would be nice to check this more quantitatively. When we exclude this region, we get a prediction for the neutrino mass that is consistent with greater than 2 sigma for order 1 priors. A degenerate hierarchy is mildly preferred. And so one can say that this says that a demonstration of cooling failure in this region will lead us to an anthropic explanation for the observed neutrino mass. Thank you. And I just want to actually leave you with a quote that I thought was appropriate giving a talk on both neutrinos and the multiverse, a quote by Pauli, who discovered, who proposed neutrinos in order to preserve energy conservation. Thank you. Yes.
It's apparently a problem with the anthropic principle of the multiverse. If you turn the measure, but, I don't have, I can dream up a different measure for Husserl.
Yeah, okay.
So I get a different answer. So the question is, how, to what extent does this anthropic principle to, predict anything?
Okay, so that's a good thing to discuss. So yes, we don't at the moment have a unique proposal for what the measure is. I would say that there has been progress in dramatically reducing the set of possible measures that are actually viable. So you could imagine, you know, randomly constructing many measures. It turns out that most of the things you could cook up immediately are ruled out for obvious reasons. For example, they predict Boltzmann brains. That they predict that observers are thermal fluctuations. They're drastic. They're ruled out for obvious reasons. And then the remaining set of possible measures. Furthermore, there's something called global local measure duality. So there's a further reduction. You may think you're talking about two separate measures, but actually there's an equivalence. So I would say that the set of measures that we have that are actually viable is a lot smaller than you would naively worry starting out. I would also say that the approach to this is phenomenological, right? So we're going to do many calculations like this for different parameters, and we're going to successively test different measures. And as we continue this program, we will narrow down to an approximation of the true measure. And this is a phenomenological approach, right? It's the same thing one would do phenomenologically in some other.
To get back to my so-called open question, if I'm clever enough to publish a paper next week on the archive, or I have an equation that determines all the masses of the standard model with a few percent prediction, and experiment that this week eventually will be determined by the neutrino mass, then that's the way physics is done.
Yeah. That's fine. I mean, I'm not claiming that everything in physics is anthropic.
Okay.
Does that?
Well, you see what I'm getting at? Why are we concerned about the anthropic?
Well, the it's just that in some cases it may be anthropic. I mean, in some cases the cosmological constant is an example of that. We haven't been able to construct an explanation for the. Why all these fine tunings cancel and give us the small number that we have. However, the anthropic approach seems to bias a lot there. So the idea is that, you know, there's some things in physics that are explained conventionally, but maybe there are other things which can't be explained, and then in that case they might be explainable using these approaches.
It took a long time to understand hydrogen energy levels. We had to find the Schrodinger equation. There's still a ways to go. By the way, after I publish this bit, I can buy my ticket up to Stockholm.
Are there other questions?
So here's a different question.
Yeah.
The spirit of what you thought at the end sounds like it's similar to the cosmological constant in that there's an anthropic reason that basically kills everything past a certain point, and then the nice observation is that that point is not so far from the observed value.
Exactly. Although there's a difference in the case of the cosmological constant. So the distinction you should draw is that in the cosmological constant, it turns out that what does the work for you is the measure in more modern approaches. Here, really, the dependence is in this anthropic factor. So originally Weinberg did this calculation for the cosmological constant and said that, you know, it correlated the value of lambda with the scale at which things became nonlinear.
That was similar to this one.
That was similar to this, but so that had some various problems. One being that the measure didn't really make sense. Another being that there's some degeneracy with if you try to vary the primordial density contrast. So the more modern approaches, actually, what you find is that it's the causal patch that does the work for you.
Those degeneracies though would still be here.
No, they're not. No. If you use the causal patch, it's not. In that case of that calculation, it's the measure that does the work. Here, really what matters is this anthropic factor. That's
so,
the difference.
So what you said about the degeneracy, so if I did a joint probability distribution for neutrino masses and sigma 8 and cosmological constant, you're saying that I wouldn't expect, you're not expecting that would make it a weaker argument for the anthropic reasoning, because this observation that you're not far from the boundary won't change. You're not expecting to get a bigger volume in parameter space.
Yeah, so the philosophy here is we start by varying one parameter, and we see if that's consistent. If it's not, then this is ruled out. And then we successively add different parameters and see if at any point along the way you find that there's some conflict. And it's consistent to say, if I'm in one slice, I'm unlikely, then that's enough. If I find I'm likely, then I should just go to the next step and make sure, try to understand the full parameter space. Here, for definiteness, I've started by varying one parameter.
But stronger than that, so I was just surprised by what you said in the sense that I thought that if you did sigma 8 and cosmological constant, it makes the argument weaker because of this degeneracy, but you're saying that the degeneracy is actually an artifact of the way Weinberg did it and is causal.
In the case of the cosmological constant, yeah. Also, I don't think you would be varying sigma 8, but...
AS, call it AS.
AS,
yeah. Call it
AS.
Yeah, right, not sigma 8.
Yeah.
And you're saying with the CC, basically everything is coming from the volume of the causal patch. Like if I make AS smaller, structure forms later, but I've still got a preference for low CC because that's got the largest, because I'm increasing the size of the causal patch instead of the CC.
So the causal patch ties, so the causal patch, the volume of the causal patch, it's exponentially diluted after some time t lambda. And doing the calculation with the causal patch links the time of observation with this time t lambda, but it doesn't have dependence on the time the time that things virialize, which in turn depends on the AS.
Cosmological constant problem is probably connected to understanding quantum gravity and the vacuum energy in association with quantum gravity. We obviously don't understand that, but we will eventually.
Yeah, so this is all kind of like a phenomenological approach to that. If we understood quantum gravity, we would hope that we understand what the prescription is for regulating these infinities, what the appropriate measure is. But in the meantime, we're not just going to throw up our hands and say, sorry, let's go watch TV. In the meantime, we're gonna try a bottom-up approach.
It took 50 years to solve low-temperature superconductivity. And no one was using the anthropic principle to do it.
Pretty hard.
They were inventing TV.
But, I mean, in this case, there's...
They were inventing TV if they had been invented.
Okay.
So the development TV is the fall civilization.
That leads us to plot number 12.
Anyway, okay, well, so we're heading to lunch, and there will be dinner tonight at 6 in the bistro. Let's thank Claire again.